Hello, and welcome to the Northern Soul podcast. I'm Laura Brown. This month, we ask a question. Are we snobbish when it comes to art? Let me explain where this comes from. I have this theory that I call threshold phobia, and you're going to hear me talking about this. The physical act of walking into a room when you don't know what to expect is hard. It takes confidence to step into the unknown. In the arts, if we have this snobbish idea about art that's really popular, perhaps not being as good as art that's very intellectual, are we risking putting people off? Are we saying, this isn't for you, you won't get this? How do we reduce those thresholds and make it easier for everyone to consume art, whatever it is? I've spoken to three people who work in three very different places, and I asked whether we are too snobbish, and if that's having an impact on who comes to see works, and how sustainable our arts organisations and our communities are. First, Michael Simpson, the Director of Visual Art and Engagement at the Lowry, says yes, we are snobbish, but we're not as bad as we were.
I just think culturally, and as a society, we're getting better at understanding the diversity and the value of arts, and that a lot of art organisations, a lot of artists, and a lot of companies like Royal Court are getting better than ever at finding ways to communicate, get the message across about what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it. And if I'm being honest, I think the whole kind of quality of what's out there has gone up across the board in terms of dance and theatre and visual arts. And I think particularly as younger generations start to engage more and more with the arts, my sense is they're just not interested in the old cliches of whether something is art or not, or whether it's good art or not. I think there's a much broader, more imaginative, a less constrained view of the arts, particularly from younger generations, and that, I think, I hope, means that that kind of snobbishness that you're talking about will slowly kind of percolate out of the art establishment.
It's quite interesting that, isn't it? Because what we kind of talk about when we're talking about arts marketing is we all sort of spend a lot of time and a lot of energy trying to engage with younger people and go, how do we do that? You know, are we using the right channels? But from what you're saying, it's that sense of younger people are going to find what they're interested in anyway, and we should maybe stop worrying about that as much as we are.
It is, but it's also, you know, we must keep reminding ourselves that there isn't art in schools, or the art that is in schools is absolutely on the absolute margins of the national curriculum, on the margins of what the school day is about. And that means that you have young people growing up who, unless they're fortunate, I suppose, in terms of being in a family or a community that does have access to the arts or engages with the arts, they're going to grow up largely without it. And so, personally, I don't think I'm the only one who feels that working for an arts organisation, I've got a responsibility to make sure that everybody gets engagement with the arts, and that includes young people who, frankly, spend 3/4 of their lives at school, and that means have during that time have very little engagement with art, because it's all about maths and English and history and all those really important things. But art is virtually written out of the school day completely. So I think there's the arts organisations just feel a responsibility to try and do their bit to help young people engage with arts. Plus, you know, just like a bank wants to sign you up when you're 16, because then they know they've probably got you for the rest. I've been with the same bank since I was 16, so never bothers to change. I think it's the same in the art world. The younger that you can connect with, the sooner you can connect with somebody, the more likely they are to live their lives looking at art, engaging with art, and liking art or hating art or whatever it might be. So It's yes, you're right, it is a slight obsession it's a real obsession that arts organisations have, but it's for the very best reasons, I think.
When we look at somewhere like the Lowry, where you've got you know, a night of ballet, you've got an exhibition, you've got something that might be very, very mainstream that everyone will have heard of, and then something that's possibly a little bit more difficult that you have to do more selling in and more education about. This is why this is interesting. You know, you might get a slightly different audience for that. How does that change the way you're talking about all the programme of work that you're doing? Or does it change the way you're talking about it? Do we have to pitch everything the same, and do we have to think about selling everything to everybody all of the time?
Well, it can't be for everybody all the time. I think that's my starting point. Across a year, across a programme, across a lifetime, if you like, an organisation has a responsibility to embrace as diverse audience as it possibly can, but it can't possibly make every show for everybody all the time. But the secret, I think, is in the mix. So we're very fortunate at the Lowry. We have three major theatres, we have a suite of art galleries, we have an ever-changing programme. So at any one day you can come in here, and certainly in the theatres you could have the Gruffalo in one theatre and the National Theatre in the next, and a community production in our studio theatre, whatever it might be. That mix means that actually, theatres-wise, we have the opportunity to embrace broad audiences. But in the art galleries, where we have the Lowry collection alongside a programme of special exhibitions, it tends to be one exhibition at a time. I don't necessarily set out to make each exhibition thoroughly accessible for every single type of audience, because that's impossible. What I try and do is make sure that over a year I've got a range of exhibitions that target family audiences, that target, and the next one might target young people, the next one might target people who are, you know, really interested in dance, and there's an exhibition for them. So it's that breadth. Now, having said that, you can to some extent have your cake and eat it, because you can work really hard to make sure that a show, for instance, that's targeted at families, you'll also find ways to talk to people who aren't part of a family but could still get an awful lot out of an exhibition. And so that's the range of interpretation you put alongside an exhibition. And the useful thing for the Lowry is that our galleries are full of what we call gallery interpreters. So they're there to have conversations with anybody who comes in, to ask them about what they're looking at, what they might like, and they go away if nobody wants to talk, absolutely fine. But if you know, they're there to start those conversations and to help people get some kind of inroads into particular works or particular themes and so on. But in terms of trying to make exhibitions that work for everybody all the time, that's you're just going to fail on just about every level if you try and do that. So the key for me is to look broadly at a year's worth of programming and see how many different audiences I can be targeting over that year.
The thing when you have that diverse program, I suppose, from that kind of marketing perspective, is that how do you, if you have someone who's coming in for a family show or a family exhibition, and maybe it's the first time they've come in, how do you then say to them, oh, you've come here for this, you might enjoy this other night at the opera, you might not have tried that before, but hey, why don't you do this? How do you communicate the breadth of your offer to that diverse audience and sell in things that they perhaps wouldn't have thought that they would enjoy, to encourage them to try new things?
Oh, that's the $64,000 question. That's you're absolutely right. That is the big question, and it's something we constantly wrestle with, because it, you know, tonight we've got the Birmingham Royal Ballet in doing Cinderella. Now it'll be packed to the rafters. Now, as someone who works in the visual arts, what I want is a piece of that audience to come in and engage with the exhibition in the, you know, our artworks in our galleries. So there it's just working collaboratively with my colleagues across the building, so in marketing, in press, in our learning teams, in our programming teams, how can we find ways to connect what BRB Cinderella with other things that are happening around the building. And, you know, there's some good old-fashioned ways of doing that, kind of if you like this, then you might like that sort of thing. But at the heart of it, it's all about communication. It has to be about communication, and that has to be a two-way thing. And I think what organisations, including the Lowry, are getting so much better at through the joys of social media, if you like, is having conversations with audiences and putting things out there and then seeing how people respond, and then literally almost on a one-to-one basis trying to guide them to other things. But it is the key challenge for an organization like us, for any organization, is to make sure that audiences can think beyond their what they feel comfortable with necessarily, and just maybe test themselves or dip their toe in other things, and that's what we're always looking to try and do.
There's a theory I have that I call threshold phobia, and it's about this sense of how do we encourage people to get over that possible fear that what's in that room, what's in that gallery space, or what's in that exhibition isn't for them. Because actually crossing that doorway and crossing that threshold for something where you don't know what to expect is quite hard. So how do you, if you've never done it, it's quite a hard thing to do. And I think that sense of whether this space is for me, whether this art is for me, really, really is part of that. So how do you reduce that fear, I guess?
I have exactly the same with posh clothes shops. I'm strictly a Marks and Spencer sort of person, so I will hang around in the doorway of Calvin Klein or whatever, but I just can't bring myself to go in. And I know that sounds if I'm kind of being trite, but genuinely, there are thresholds that I really feel uncomfortable crossing for really no good reason. But you're absolutely right that whole threshold phobia, I think, is a really important point. We have it here. We have, to get to our galleries, you have to go up a set of escalators. And you might think, well, that's fantastic. An escalator is pulling you up and you don't have to climb up the stairs. It's nice and easy. But actually, it represents a huge barrier for our theatre audiences, who, even leaving the ground floor where the cafe is and the shop is and everybody else is, just going up the escalator is crossing that threshold, let alone they'll get to the top of the escalator and they'll get a lovely warm welcome and a big smile from the person at the top of the escalator. But just that action of going up the escalators is already a barrier. And buildings, are always trying to look for ways to help people get across that threshold. And then you get to the threshold where I'll have audiences who are comfortable going in to see an L.S. Lowry exhibition because they feel they know a bit of L.S. Lowry and they feel L.S. Lowry is for them. But the exhibition right next door to it, and there might be an abstract painting on the wall opposite them, that's the next threshold that they have to cross. And so that, I think you're absolutely right. That is the key moment. If you can get people through, someone can get me into Calvin Klein, I'll probably end up buying a pair of socks or something. If we can get our audiences into some of these spaces and then help them relax, help them engage, have the conversation. If they don't like it, absolutely fine. But getting them in and getting them to give it a go is really such a tough challenge.
So when we're talking about elitism and snobbery and populism, is one of the things that we're talking about making spaces accessible and making it as easy for people to move around as they need to? So are we talking about accessibility more than anything else?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with you there, because I genuinely think museums and galleries are more accessible than they have ever been, not only physically there, but in terms of before a visit and after a visit and during a visit. I think there's been a significant drop in visitors to museums and galleries over the last couple of years. But that is, for me, I don't believe that that's about accessibility. I think that's about impact of tourism to this country. I think it's about the huge cuts in cultural budgets up and down the country, so venues have less money to put on less exhibitions or to do less marketing or all those sorts of things. I go back to the thing about schools, the biggest drop is something like 6.9% or something, a drop in school visits. That's because there aren't the resources for schools to be able to book the coaches, to take the kids, all those sorts of things. So I think there's loads of factors that have meant that in the last couple of years, museum and gallery visitors have dropped. Now, that's not to say that, you know, there isn't immense amount of work always to be done in terms of making them accessible, but I think it's, personally, I'd say it's a bit too simplistic to say the drop in figures reflects a sense that art is not for people or that venues aren't accessible. Venues are working their socks off to be as accessible as they possibly can. They have no choice. If they want any public funding, I tell you, the hoops you go through in terms of public funding in order to prove how hard you're working for accessibility are immense. So it's that will always remain a factor to some degree, but there's a whole range of factors that are really having a significant impact on museum and gallery visitors. And as I say, for me, the big one is schools not having the resources to be able to engage. The 6 or 7% drop in school visits is by far the largest single element in that reduction in visits.
Mike James is a marketing manager who's worked in the arts for 25 years. He's been everywhere from the Unity Theatre in Liverpool to the Liverpool Empire. I asked him simply, are we too snobby when it comes to art?
Good question. I would say yes and no. Yes, I think we are in certain aspects and certain parts of the culture we have, particularly in Liverpool as a city region, but also no, in that we have such a broad offer for audiences, from the populist right through to the very elitist, very eclectic. And I think we're quite unique as a city in that, from that point of view.
I think from your perspective it's quite interesting because you've worked freelance. You worked at the Unity Theatre, which people don't know does do a lot of popular stuff. They do a lot of comedy. They do a lot of very accessible plays and performances. But there is quite a lot of theatre and performance art that's quite difficult to get your head around, possibly. Yeah. It's also a theatre that if people don't know it, it's kind of tucked away on a back street. It's a little bit hard to find if you don't know it. And then you've also worked sort of at the other end of the scale almost at the Liverpool Empire, which is one of the biggest theatres in the city, that does your Evitas, your Les Mis's, the shows that everyone's sort of heard of. How was it different working at the two different venues? Was it completely... What was it like kind of having the two different ends of the scale when it comes to theatre?
Interesting that, because I went from the Unity to the Empire. Being at the Unity was a fantastic experience simply because it's the kind of work deep in my heart I really, really love and really, you know, and have an empathy for. But at the extremes at the Unity, I think, are quite similar to those at the Empire in a weird sort of way. The Unity, you know, has lived its life offering eclectic and new and exciting and innovative art for audiences. But alongside that, has always had its heart in the city and in the arts audience of the city, and doesn't in any way try to be elitist. It tries to be as populist as possible in offering work and an opportunity for people to see and experience new work in a way that no other venues do, and doesn't put itself up at the highbrow level at any way there. The Empire, on the opposite end of the scale, is a big musical theatre venue with, you know, 3,000 seats, so it's quite the opposite end of the scale, but also offers a very eclectic programme in terms of ballet, opera, big West End musicals, right down to your kind of jukebox musical, Buddy Holly style. So equally, there's a breadth of audience at the Empire as there would be at the Unity. I think the difference probably is... the audience you get at the Empire is an audience that has or is more populist simply by the way it chooses to attend. The audience at the Unity are the kind of people who are seeking out new experiences. And I think rather than it being about an elitist viewpoint or a populist theatre, it's about having an offer that's relevant to the audiences that want to buy it. So by that, I simply mean that we have theatre in Liverpool called the Unity Theatre that offers the kind of eclectic art that a small minority of people really want to attend and see and are excited by seeing new stuff. That offer is there for them. We have the Royal Court Theatre offering homemade quite populist stuff that is normally of extremely high quality as well, and the audiences are there for that. We have the Empire offering West End musicals, the audiences are there for that. So I think we can talk a lot about elitist and populist and and those things in between, but actually we've got an offer in Liverpool for everybody, and I think that works. I don't think we necessarily, when we're developing audiences in the city, need to or should spend too much time worrying about the crossover.
That's just what I was going to ask. Is it a bit of the Radiohead thing where it's kind of we do it to ourselves, that in the arts we sit there and we worry about how people are seeing it, we worry about how we're being perceived and how we're seen, and it's almost like a Mean Girls thing in a way, in that we, particularly in Liverpool, and particularly when it was, you know, kind of, you know, the Big Eight, and, you know, when we were doing Capital of Culture, because both of us worked, you know, as PRs for arts organisations when it was Capital of Culture, we very much worried about what box we were sitting in as an arts organisation. But I guess perhaps our audiences didn't think about that at all.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think as arts organisations generally do worry more about that than the audiences do. Audiences will self-select what they want to see and self-select where they position themselves in relation to what they like. They're not necessarily going to go, oh no, I couldn't go and see that bit of populist theatre because it's not in a venue alike. They will go to the venue regardless of what's on to a certain extent. Some people are very, very attached to certain venues, but I think generally arts venues worry too much. I think that was probably highlighted in my experience of working at Unity and then going to the Empire, and actually realising that the audiences who buy into shows at the Empire and the musicals and the like aren't necessarily that bothered that that's what they like and that's what they do. Whereas the more elitist audiences might be more bothered about the perception of who they are and what they are in terms of their what they actually like in terms of art. So there's an interesting kind of conversation there about how people who take in populist theatre and like populist musicals and stuff like that aren't necessarily bothered that people know that they do that. Whereas your more eclectic audience might be a bit concerned if people knew they went to see Hairspray as opposed to some completely new piece of dance, you know. So there's all sorts of complications there for people, for venues, for audiences, for everybody. Yeah, I think we spend too much time worrying about it.
It's actually quite interesting when you say that, because there's a thing in Liverpool where everyone goes to see Blood Brothers whenever it's on at Liverpool. Yeah, everyone always does.
Yeah.
But you'll always have people telling the story of who was the narrator. And there's always the story as well of that night when Willie Russell did the narrator because everyone stepped in. And judging by how many people said they were there the night Willie Russell was the narrator, there must be like sort of 20,000 capacity at the Empire.
Not to have that many people in it. Yeah.
But I think that is really true, though, isn't it? That sense of sometimes audiences are kind of how they pitch themselves and how they perceive themselves alongside the arts organisation as well. You're very much kind of a wish and an identity fulfilment for them in some ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think, in terms of certain other venues, that could potentially be quite true. I mean, I worked at Fact for a while and did a strategy piece for them developing audiences, and we looked quite heavily at audience personas to try and define what sorts of people were coming to Fact and what their lifestyles were like, who they were, what they ate, what they did for a living, that sort of thing. And that certainly led us down a road of saying, well, actually, people are coming here because it suits their perceived lifestyle or their persona. You know, it's for a kind of rather rough example, you could say the hipster kind of audience would select certain things that fit in with that perceived lifestyle. Have I gone off the question, or am I just waffling?
I'm sort of
going around in circles. But I think people will. Well, yeah, it goes back to what I was saying before, really, about populist and non-populist, and people will self-select that depending on what their kind of viewpoint is and what their outlook is, and we'll talk about, as you say, certain things that it's okay to say I went to see that because it was a thing that was quite acceptable, but then it might not be okay to say you went to see something equally as populist, but you know, that people might perceive to be a little bit lowbrow.
I think
I answered your question.
I think one of the things that's quite worrying about it and how this kind of debate within the arts manifests itself is when we start talking about programming. And I guess if you work in the arts, you understand the thing of, you know, you have family-focused shows in the summertime because it's when everyone's off, so people are looking for things. You know, you time things with half-term, you time them with Christmas, but also knowing that people are very busy in the run-up to, but are looking for things in the holidays. So you have that mapped out. But there is also that worry that if you develop too much of a picture of your audience and what you think your audience is, you can run into a cul-de-sac a little bit. And I've worked at arts organisations where they have had a weird idea of what their audience is in some ways, and has and have created work that they think that audience is going to like, and they just end up talking to a smaller and smaller group of people.
Yes, definitely. Well, I think that probably goes back to the kind of the producer, if you like. West End producers have got it nailed down completely because they know who their audience is. For something like Dirty Dancing, they know who their audience is. It's middle-class women of a certain age who grew up with the film and want to go out and party with the mates and sing along to a show. That's their audience. They know it is. They don't worry about anyone else. They don't bother telling anyone else. They don't bother talking to anyone else. And that's a very clear target audience for them, and they deliver their marketing precisely at that audience. Whereas I think on the opposite end of the scale, where we're looking at arts-funded organisations who are trying to achieve specifics around audience development, it becomes a lot harder. And I think there are a lot of venues are guilty of actually having to try to produce work that fits to an audience rather than the other way around. And that can be quite stifling, I think, from an artistic perspective and creative perspective. I think that's kind of... It's a complicated one because actually you either produce great, eclectic, interesting new work and don't worry about whether the audience is there or whether anyone's going to go, this is rubbish, don't bother coming, or this is fantastic, come and see it, everybody. Or you very specifically try and gear your work towards an audience. And there's a massive... there's a massive dichotomy there just in terms of, you know, which is right and which is wrong. And actually, artists and creatives should be creating the work they want to create with the vision they want to put out there, with the aims and objectives they have for that work, without worrying too much about, ultimately, whether there's an audience for it.
Is footfall entirely the wrong metric to use when you're measuring audiences?
That depends on the kind of work you're doing, actually, doesn't it? In terms of the Big West End Musical, yes, it is exactly the right measure because you're talking about income, you're talking about commercial theatre that needs to have an income behind it, otherwise it just won't continue. Whereas actually, if you're producing new work, footfall might not necessarily be the key objective, but engagement with that work will be an objective. So you want people to come in and engage with it. You want them to have an experience rather than just sitting in their seats enjoying something and going home forgetting about it. So there's different areas there in terms of your objective, whether it's footfall or not. But if we go back to Unity, most of the work that was produced or toured to Unity when I was there was certainly more about an experience of theatre, a quite deep experience. There was one show we had that was actually, and I think there's been one recently as well, where there were actually no lights on in the auditorium at all, and it was all about smell and sense. So that's a very eclectic piece of theatre that actually relied totally on the other senses you don't normally use when you're watching a show. So you can't see anything, but you can hear sounds, you can hear noises, you can hear voices, you can smell certain things, and that's a very sensory, very deeply involving experience. So that's something that didn't necessarily rely on footfall, but relied on an audience that wanted a really engaging, deeply involving experience to take away with them. An unforgettable one, if you like.
It's quite intimidating, that though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I've worked in an art space where the galleries were very, very dark, and to actually walk through the doorway to the galleries, if you didn't know what to expect, it was quite intimidating. And I call it threshold phobia. I don't know if there's actually a phrase for that. I've made one up. That threshold phobia of trying to get people to walk over the doorway. Because I think when we are looking at, you know, the report came out last month that said that, you know, the audience figures to museums and galleries are falling. And you do have that balance where you want to do something that's exciting and pushes people. But at the same time, you want to make people feel confident that they can walk into a gallery space or a performance space and not be frightened that something might happen that they don't expect.
Yes. I think, the whole that phrase you've kind of developed there is quite useful, because I think most, or traditionally, people would be put off going to the theatre simply because they would think, well, it's not for me. Say Shakespeare, for instance, is a good example of that. And there's been so many attempts across the last God knows how many years to try and break Shakespeare down to make it more accessible. But you still have a problem where people will say, oh, Shakespeare, I don't understand that. It's not for me. So you're creating a barrier, if you like. Art galleries, I think, probably suffer from that most, and particularly contemporary art galleries, where people will assume that because it's contemporary, it's not for me. I won't understand it. I won't know what it is, blah, blah, blah. That's your threshold. That's where you're putting up that barrier and saying, no, this is only for people who understand this art. This isn't for people who might not understand it. I was actually yesterday, weirdly, I don't know why this came up in my head, but I was thinking about historically when the Walker Art Gallery first opened in Liverpool, there was actually a riot outside because the powers that be and the people that had paid for it wouldn't let the public in, even though they had declared it a public gallery. So that started me thinking, actually, well, that's quite interesting, because we now think of the Walker as just part of our city and part, you know, it's part of our lives. You know, people are quite happy to go in there and see all sorts of different types of art. And yet back in the day, they weren't letting ordinary people off the street into the gallery because they considered it to be something for the highbrow and the rich and the wealthy. I think we have a much more open attitude to that now, but we still have barriers. But we have different barriers: barriers about language, barriers about interpretation in galleries, and even in the theatre, there are probably lots of people who say go to the Royal Court in Liverpool for some of the homemade shows there, who wouldn't go to the Unity to see something quite eclectic, because equally they would think, it's not for me, I won't understand that. And that's something we've got to really, really work on. But we've been trying to work on that for years and years and years. And it brings me back to the whole thing of, well, do we need to worry about it? You know, potentially people are self-selecting stuff. They'll go and see some things, they won't go and see others. Does it matter? Do we need to worry so much about making sure that the more populist audiences are going to see more eclectic stuff and vice versa? Is it something we should spend a lot of money and time developing audiences for different products when they might not be interested? They might culturally just not attend those kind of populist stuff. They might prefer to go to eclectic and vice versa. So it's quite complex, that, I think.
When I was talking to Michael Simpson from The Lowry, one of the things we were talking about was how you cross-sell to audiences. Mm. So say you've got an audience that's going to the ballet, how you say to them, hey, there's this really exciting exhibition that you might be into, yeah, and how yeah. you sort of do that cross-sell. And he was saying what's also really important is get them while they're young. You know, get young kids Absolutely. So that they feel like it's yeah. going to an art gallery, if that's what they want to do, mm. or going to see contemporary art, or going to see, you know, a piece of theatre, that it becomes normal so that they have the confidence to pick what they want to go and see when they get
yeah.
older.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely vitally important, actually. I think most people who are kind of probably the same age as me, sort of middle-aged, middle-class people, will say, oh, yes, I can remember my first theatre experience when my dad took me or my mum took me or whatever. And that's, I think, something that is probably in younger people less visible or less, or heard less, simply because they're not getting those early experiences. I think that's really important. I think education is important. Education in schools, in terms of art and culture and creativity, you know, it should be right at the centre of it. You know, and I think as human beings, we are creative and we are cultural, so we should be encouraged to do that as much as possible. Where I'm working at the moment at Nugent, we've just had done a project with the Everyman Theatre, which has involved there's a word for it, I can't remember what it is, but talking to young people from Kirkdale about their experiences in Kirkdale, their experiences of growing up in Kirkdale. And a lot of those young people had never experienced theatre before, never been part of that kind of process. And they went to Stratford to see the final piece of work that had come out of that study, and were completely bowled over by it. It was performed by a group of actors, some who from Liverpool as well, and the dynamic between the performance and the audience was not what you'd normally expect either. So they're actually engaging with the theatre piece by talking, by shouting out when the actors say something that's come directly from something they've said. And that, I think, is a great experience for young people. Being able to sit in a theatre and actually communicate with the actors whilst they're performing, breaking down the barrier of that, goes back to the threshold thing. You know, it's opening it up in a way that actually allows them to express themselves in a way that is quite different to what we would normally do in a theatre. I think that's part of giving people the opportunity to experience it for themselves in a way that they understand as well. But from an education point of view, I think we've gone through several periods there of across the last 25 years where, when I was first working with Everyman, we had schools in pretty much every single day of the week. Regardless of what the show was, we would have matinees for schools. And English teachers and drama teachers from all the big schools in Liverpool were coming regularly. And we had group booking officers who solely dealt with schools because it was such a big part of what we were doing. And that isn't happening anywhere near as much now. It's really been stripped out of schools, that whole idea of taking kids out to a theatre trip once or twice a month to actually experience that alongside their curriculum studies. It just doesn't happen anywhere near as much. And that is a problem, because that's actually taking out the future, really, for theatre and for the arts in many areas. You know, if we don't have people who are learning and training and understanding that from a very early age and having it embodied in them, that that's important, then where are we in 20, 30 years' time when those kids are growing up? Where are the creative people going to be? Where are the theatre producers going to be?
Finally, Sam Lackey, who's Senior Curator of Programme at the Whitworth. With a £15 million redevelopment, the Whitworth has physically changed how people get into the building and how they connect the communities they're already part of. I asked her what she thought about the snobbery in art that affects popular and elitist art.
I think that there is a snobbery that exists. I'd like to think that it didn't exist at the Whitworth, but there is, in the art world, kind of set of complicated ideas around popular art and around high art and how that might operate, in particularly in our public institutions.
Where do you think, I know this is quite a big question, where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes from all sorts of things. I think it comes from one is a kind of major historical context, so that derives from really particular specific moments. So there is, you know, an idea. Gosh, I'm not being very clear. Let me think. It really comes from the development of institutions and history of art and art appreciation over the 20th and 21st century. And part of that is to do with broader social conditions, and part of that is to do with the way we experience it now. So famously, I guess the kind of one starting point for this was an essay that was written in the 40s by Clement Greenberg, famous art critic, who wrote Avant-Garde and Kitsch, which is like this major essay that's about the threat of kitsch and popular art forms to high art. And he was writing at a really specific moment when totalitarian regimes were taking over Europe and artists and artist practice were being attacked. And writing in the context of the Degenerate Art Exhibition in Germany, where the works of Klee and Kandinsky and amazing modernist artists were shown as these appalling works of art. And that is one point for making a distinction between popular forms of art that he identified with social control and high art. So that's kind of the one ideological position, I think, that exists in one way. And then there are much kind of broader ideas about how art, I think, and how visual imagery operates culturally, and about the artists who are popular and how the kind of values that we give to them. Often very great artists can convey the most important idea about their work in a very simple way, in a written way. And that kind of honing down of an idea about artist practice is often a sign of something that's really interesting and really good. And also, I don't think it's necessarily the institution's job to explain every single way or every single way that the artist has considered that work. Once it kind of enters the public space, then it's there, and it's there to be engaged with by everybody, and it's the work itself that you have to respond to.
How far does it fit into your programming when you're thinking about audiences? Because I think for people who I mean, I say just consumers of art, you know, but people who go to galleries and go to exhibitions and go to theatre shows and very much enjoy doing that, whatever kind of art form that is, perhaps don't know the sort of layers of thinking, I guess, that goes into how do we program this at different times of year and how do we engage with different people and who might be the people that are interested in this show. But before you even start, you know, planning it, how, talk a little bit about that sort of process of how the audience factors into your thinking in that way.
Well, I think the process always begins with the work and the artists. But then at a very early stage, we start thinking straight away about the audiences that we think might be interested in it, the audiences who aren't engaged with it, but who we would really like to be engaged with it, and how we might work with the content of the exhibition or the artist, with our learning teams, with our publicity, to think about all those things at the same time as we're in the really early stages of planning the exhibition. So it's, in one way, there's kind of a set of parameters, but they tend to happen after or at the very beginning of the project. So just as we're thinking about working with an artist or a historical show, then also thinking about the audiences. Sometimes it works a bit differently. We're working on a great project at the moment with artists from South Asia. So really thinking partly about the Whitworth South Asian audiences and the people who live directly around us and how we might engage with them, with our collections, with what we already have, and by working with different artists. So in that case, it was a really engaged idea about connecting with a particular audience, but also about embedding artists from international artists into a program that everybody would enjoy in Manchester too.
That is often the thing, isn't it? That it's, I think, particularly when you're building based as well, that idea of having, you know, having to talk one way to the audience, well, it's not talking a different way, but having, being very conscious of the audience that's on your doorstep, very conscious of the audience that might be, you know, down the M62 in either direction.
Yep.
You know, the audience that's down in London that might be a lot of opinion formers, and the one internationally. How far does that kind of thinking about all those different layers of audience, is that something that you, how does that sort of play a role?
Well, there are different ways of thinking about it. The most straightforward is quite simply that we have, especially since the work and the new development of the Whitworth, we have a huge amount of galleries and we program 18 to 20 exhibitions a year.
Wow.
So that allows us in one year to show all sorts of different kinds of work that would appeal to all sorts of different kinds of people. It's all free, and the one of the kind of principles of it is if you come in to see a Warhol show, which is the show that we have on at the moment, you might go and see a Raimondi and Raphael show, which is what we have upstairs as well. And then you might go downstairs and see an exhibition that's being co-curated by our Whitworth Young Contemporaries with works in the exhibition. So by just having the luxury of that physical space and the ability to program many, many different types of exhibition, we think that we have, you know, we're in a really privileged position actually to think about multiple audiences at the same time. But I think that what we'd like to do, or what we'd like to think about doing, is provide, you know, putting on really accessible exhibitions, but exhibitions that also operate on those different planes. So our forthcoming show this autumn is by Rux Media Collective, who are a critically acclaimed, brilliant arts collective who haven't really had a major show in the UK or Europe before. They're from India. They're part of or connected to our project of working with South Asian organisations and artists. But at the same time, as we think it will connect with particularly with certain audiences, we also think that it will operate as an exhibition that people who are very highly engaged with art practice will also come and see. So in the best of all worlds, exhibitions and artists can often connect through in that way. You know, great art, really great art, is accessible to everybody.
The Whitworth, the new development, sort of £15 million, and it's so beautiful, and the, you know, the space looks so incredible. But I think that, I suppose that investment as well, do you think that when people see you, you know, we are investing in making this space bigger and making this space look so beautiful and so striking and so lovely, do you think that changes accessibility as well, that people think, oh, you're investing in it, so I will invest in it, if that makes sense?
I think it's probably not unhelpful that a building and an organisation looks as though it's cared for and that it's supported well, and that that investment that comes from all sorts of different directions also is perpetuated through the people that come and spend time in that organisation. I mean, the other thing that the extension did was it literally opened up the back of the gallery. So we have this second entrance, and that's an entrance that doesn't connect like our traditional front entrance, which is fronted on the university and the main road, but opens out to a park and to the communities around us in Moss Side in particular, that are directly behind us, and sets us up as a space or as a place that's as close to those communities as it is to the university community. So that's really important for us, that we're this kind of literal pathway between one place in Manchester and another, between the very local and then the international reach and aspiration of the university, and that we occupy physically and conceptually perhaps a space in the middle, a space where those areas can really mix.
That's it for this month. If you want to read the best writing in the North by Northern writers, go to northernsoul.me.uk. You'll also find out there how you can enter the Northern Soul Awards 2017. With that, that's it from me. Have a great month.